can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
We have here tonight a wonderful lady named Mairead Corrigan McGuire, and she spent years working with other people to end the Troubles, as they call them, in Northern Ireland, in which thousands of people were killed and others injured. And when she formed the Community of Peace People, they organized demonstrations and peace walks and activities of all kinds that eventually involved 500,000 people, 500,000 people in a part of Ireland. I can't imagine anybody being able to organize that many people over here in a much bigger country. But she did, and in 1976, she was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize with her co-chairman, Betty Williams. And later, we gave her a Peace Leadership Award from the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. But when the Kelly Lectures were established, I felt that I wanted to see as many women as possible as speakers in that series. Those lectures may have to go on for many years because we are not approaching an end to the philosophy that war is an acceptable human activity. It is not. It is a criminal activity, and we must bring an end to war. So tonight, I have the great honor of presenting a glorious being. I say she is glorious because she is linked to the God of love, to the God of fellowship with one another, of acceptance of one another as being a part of a great march of humanity through history. It is my honor and privilege to present Mairead Corrigan McGuire.
Irish champagne. My dear brothers and sisters, it's a great joy for me to be here with you this evening. And I'd like to thank Frank for his lovely words. And I'd like to thank Frank for Kelly for all his years of working for peace and nuclear disarmament. And it's a great privilege for me to be back here at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation with David Krieger and Carol Lee. I was here in 1991, and it just seems like yesterday. And I want to say, stop. Life is going past too quickly. And I can't do that, because life goes past very quickly. And I think that's why it's very important that we live in the minute. And the minutes that we have to gather are brief but intense. And then we won't have any regrets. I think it's very important as well that the minutes that we live our minutes of truth. Because in a sense, all we can do is seek truth in our own lives and live out of that truth with as much integrity as we possibly can. And then we have nothing to regret, because we will have done what was asked of us. You know, sometimes we live in the world today and we see so many problems and wonder, what can I do about this? Where will I start? It kind of reminds me, you know, in Ireland we're always telling stories. And there's one goes that in Northern Ireland we had a couple of American visitors and they were lost in the road and looking for the way to Belfast. So they stopped a local farmer and they said to the farmer, can you tell us how we get to Belfast? And the farmer said, well, if I was you, I wouldn't start from here. And I don't know about you, but we look out on the world today and there's so many problems. And I kind of say, where do we start? And something in me says, oh my God, we didn't want to start from here, because we've a lot of problems in our world today. And do we prioritize? Do we say, yes, there is global warming, we've got to do something about it? Do we say, yes, there's dreadful poverty, we've got to do something about it? Or do we say, well, there's nuclear weapons, we've got to do something about it? Do we say it's time for no more wars? Do we say it's time that we say no to violence, no to war, no to nuclear weapons? Or do we prioritize? Or do we simply have another drink and get on and enjoy our lives? I think we mix both. I think life's for enjoying yourself. It's for celebrating. And perhaps we need more music, more dance, more beauty in the world today. And you know, if the University of California is teaching its finest minds and its beautiful people to make weapons that are dropped on our brothers and sisters around the world, that's a tragedy. That's an insult to our humanity. That's thrown back in the face of God, the gift of life. But if the University of California has smart young men and women, they are intelligent enough because they got to the University of California in the first place. They are intelligent enough to ask, is what I am doing beautifying life? Or is what I am doing destroying life? And they were given free will. And they must make the choice. Life is all about using your intelligence, your imagination, and your creativity and making a choice. So can we make good choices, or do we make bad choices? You know, Einstein once said, we are moral technological giants and moral pygmies. Today in our world, we have become technological giants. And for many, we remain moral pygmies. Because any country that can talk about increasing its nuclear weapons and weaponizing the stars and building bunker busters and building more nuclear weapons when it already has thousands of nuclear weapons has lost its way. We must become seekers of truth and speakers of truth. And that's the hard thing. You see, we know that life is sacred. We know what to do that's right. But do we do it? Do we have the courage to speak truth to power? Truth tellers often pay a high price for telling the truth. But we have models in our world today which are wonderful examples of people who told the truth. We have in Burma Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Laureate, who, because she took on the Burmese government asking for human rights and democracy, is now 10 years under house arrest in Rangoon. We know we have Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli nuclear peace activist, who 20 years ago told the world that Israel had nuclear weapons. And what happened? He was arrested. He did 18 years in an Israeli prison as a young man, 12 in a small cell in solitary confinement, because he told the truth, because he tried to waken us up to the fact that nuclear weapons can be the new catastrophe in our world. And that's what he tried to tell us. And today, Mordecai Vanunu is not allowed to leave Israel because the Israeli government hold him. For 2 years now, 20 years in total, he's held inside Israel, not allowed to speak to foreigners and not allowed to talk to foreign press and not allowed to leave Israel. An innocent man. And what the Israeli government doing are holding a freed man and saying, you're not allowed to speak. Hey, come off it. Don't we live in a world with human rights and international laws? Aren't we allowed to speak to each other? And yet we have a world remaining silent on these heroes of our time. And that's our tragedy, that we haven't built institutions and organizations to defend our human rights, our international laws. We must demand of our governments that they tell truth and they act out of a moral and ethic basis. You see, we've been told so many lies that it's time people within our countries stand up and speak out for what is right for all our sakes. In 1999, I went to Iraq with Adolfo Perez Esquivel from Argentina and Nobel Peace Laureate. And what I witnessed in Iraq, I will remember for the rest of my life. We went to the Amariya shelter in Baghdad, where in 1991, in February, what was Aish Wednesday and the end of Ramadan, two American smart bombs were dropped on a center where over 500, mostly women and children, Iraqis were incinerated and turned to dust on Ash Wednesday by Christian pilots. Doesn't that say something to you about where the Christians are at? We went to the hospital, the Mansour Hospital, for pediatrics for children. And we looked at young children lying, dying of diseases. Over 500,000 Iraqi children died in Iraq as a direct result of the first Gulf War, which took out the whole infrastructure in Iraq and the economic trade sanctions put on by the USA, the UK, and the UN against the Iraqi people. The Iraqi people were on their knees, and not only the Iraqi children were dying, a whole country was slowly being destroyed by Western policies. We were told in Iraq in 1999, UMSCON done its job so well that Iraq is no military threat to anybody outside its own borders. There are no longer any nuclear weapons in Iraq. If we were told that in 1999, then that was known by intelligence agencies. So why did Bush and Blair lie to us and take us to war? We must stand up and say very clearly, war is too high a price for us to pay any longer. Do you know, when I think of the cost of the Iraqi war, I have to pray that I don't get angry or that I don't spend my time crying. Over 2,000 American soldiers dead. Do you know over 300 of those young soldiers have come back with brain damage? 300. Just think about that, because these figures, we can get lost in figures. What does it mean, brain damage? 15,000 of them are back damaged. American soldiers in your country today. Over 100 UK soldiers. But let's take it down. You get lost in figures. Let's take it down from 300 being brain damaged to, let me tell you a story, when I hear the word brain damage, what it means to me, because we have to get out of the clouds here and down to what it means in human suffering. In 1976, Northern Ireland was on the brink of war. We had bombings and shootings and killings every day. It's worse in Iraq today, and God help us, it's going to be worse for the Iraqi people for a long time to come. It'll be worse for them, and it'll go on longer for them than it went on for Northern Ireland, I'm very sad to say. But in August 76, one of my younger sisters took her four children for a walk round to visit my mommy. And it was a clash between an active service unit of the IRA and the British soldiers. And the British soldiers shot the young IRA man through the head, and he was killed outright. Danny Lennon, 19 years of age. Three of my sister's children were all killed. And can you imagine? Andrew was 6 weeks old. John was 2.5. Joanne was 8. And Anne was dangerously ill and not expected to live. All in a flash, a family wiped out. That's what started the peace people in Northern Ireland. And Anne recovered slightly. Miraculously had two beautiful daughters, but had brain damage like your 300 young soldiers. And she never survived. She committed suicide on the 21st of January 1980 because in her note to her husband, "Forgive me, I can't go on. I love you. If we cannot look at what's happening in Iraq today and say, bring the soldiers home. Why? For the sake of them and their families. Why else? For the sake of the Iraqi people. They're not a solution to Iraq today. They're part of the problem. And we have to face that truth. And who will bring the soldiers home? Are you going to wait till there's another 300 brain damaged, or another 15,000 maimed, or another 2,500 dead? Are you going to wait? I don't know. What a big question I ask is, why do the American people keep paying this price for war? What is it that's in your psyche that you allow this to go on? I remember meeting Professor Wald, who is a Nobel Peace Laureate, an American man, and I met him a long time ago when I didn't understand what I was getting involved in the peace movement. And he said to me about America, he said, you know, The American people are great people, and I agree with them. I've been to America many times, and I love it. There's people in this audience that are like family to me. Nancy Nordoff's here, a great friend, and Lynn, people I love dearly, who've helped me on all these years. But he said, you know, the American people are like people everywhere around the world. He said, they want peace. They don't want their children to go to war. But he says, the tragedy is that the military-industrial complex is so strong in America. America has built our economy on war. 1 in 6 in the military-industrial complex. And when you build an economy around a war, you need an enemy. And I was confused by this. But in those days, the enemy was Russia, communism, war. Who is the enemy today for the American, for this administration? This administration has told us that we are going to have war on terrorism. And we are assured by the Pentagon and the White House that we are now facing into eternal wars. Well, I can tell you, here's one woman who's saying, there's no way I'm going to stand by and let America or any other country lead us into eternal wars. War has had its day. Wars are not honorable anymore. Civilians, women, and children mostly die in wars. That's who pays the price of wars. So it's time we said they've had their day. And why? Because there are alternatives. It's a bit like Northern Ireland, you see. The world has changed. I mean, we're still operating on an old model that we used a long time ago. The world has changed. We're now operating in a world where we're interconnected, we're interdependent, and we have huge problems like the environment and poverty and all those other things. We are in a different ball game, brothers and sisters, and Americans know their ball games. And this is one ball game you're going to have to find new rules for. The Cold War is over. The real wars now are those within states, failed states, the like of Northern Ireland. Look at Northern Ireland. Learn from Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, we had a deep ethnic political problem. We never solved it through militarism, and we had the British Army in Northern Ireland. Couldn't deal with it. We never solved it through paramilitarism, and we had our paramilitaries. Some people called them freedom fighters, but at least, thank God, the armed struggle is over, so there's no hope of Bush dropping a nuclear bomb in West Belfast, where I live, to get the terrorists. Very interesting what's going on here in our world today. You know, where is the reason? In Northern Ireland, America sent Senator Mitchell to negotiate. God love him. He'd done a great job, a great man, and he helped us build our peace process. And the British and Irish governments and Tony Blair helped build the peace process in Northern Ireland. And what do you do in the Middle East? What do you do in Iraq? You send in awe and terror and bombing and destruction and kill over 100,000 Iraqis, mostly women and children. Why was Iraq different from Northern Ireland? You didn't send in the army. And Tony Blair didn't send in the bombers when we had our crises in Northern Ireland, thank God. Why did he take the opposite route from what he'd done in Northern Ireland when they spoke to the insurgency groups and told them, come in out of the cold, we need to solve this problem. Thank God, it's the only way to do it. Why did they use different methods in Iraq? The only way to solve the Iraqi problem is get the troops out and start talking to the insurgents and deal with the problem on the ground. It's the only way. There is no other way. Learn what happened in Northern Ireland. Iraq will not be solved by lifting young men, setting aside normal judicial process and locking them up in Guantanamo Bay. You take Guantanamo, that's what makes people angry. That's why there's so much anger in the Middle East. It makes sense. Don't you get angry when you're trusted, when you're treated unjustly? It's a fascinating thing about the human person. You know, why do we not take the lessons we learn in our own hearts and apply them to solving international problems? When the human person gets treated unjustly, or the anger grows, and they feel so frustrated and so angry that they can go out and literally kill, we need to work for just solutions and not treat people unjustly. Otherwise, we feed the anger and the pain. So close Guantanamo Bay. The young men in it, bring them under normal judicial process to trial as quickly as possible. Uphold human rights. Apply international laws. And the Middle East problem will begin to take care of itself. Why is the Middle East so angry? Well, if you were a Palestinian being treated the way you are by the Israeli government, your home demolished, walls built, an apartheid system being built by the Israeli government, you would be angry. And if you were an Arab watching what's happening in Iraq and what might well begin to happen in Iran, if we don't get organized, you would be angry. So let's understand, we need to go a different route. The American government and its current foreign policies is one of the greatest blocks to peace in the world today, and is feeding terrorism and insurgency movements. And unless this present American administration goes on to a new road, we are heading into a crisis the like of which we might not get out of. Nuclear weapons. You know, I was in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I was also in Auschwitz concentration camp. And you really have got to ask the question, how do we get into this position as a human family? Where did our compassion go? Where did our love of each other go? Where did our feeling of empathy for one another go when we can do the like of that to other human beings? And when we can plan nuclear weapons and nuclear bombs and have those stockpiled that we might drop them on our brothers and sisters, where's our morality? Where's our humanity? Because people all over the world are our brothers and sisters. So in the world today, America is leading the nuclear arms race. Because what America is doing, America is saying it's ignoring its duties under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty because it won't agree to the conditions within that and start to get rid of its nuclear bombs. So what it's saying, it's building up new nuclear weapons, spending billions of pounds for them, and it's saying to countries like Iran and North Korea, it's all right for us to have nuclear weapons. We're the good guys. We can be trusted with nuclear weapons. Forget the fact we dropped them. But we can be trusted with nuclear weapons. Forget the fact we dropped them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and never said we're sorry. You've never said you're sorry to the Japanese people yet. And a people who don't say they're sorry can do it again. So America is the block on us disarming the world of nuclear war, nuclear weapons. Britain, Tony Blair and the whole refurbishing of the Trident nuclear submarines. £60 million it will cost for Britain to refurbish its nuclear submarines. What couldn't we do in Belfast with £60 million? And if they do that, then they are almost tearing up the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty because it won't mean anything, because they are not meeting any commitments to decommission. And I know Tony Blair comes and tells us in Belfast, get rid of your guns. But we say to Tony Blair, and you get rid of your nuclear bombs. Do you know, the double think and the hypocrisy with all this, we've got to start getting a wee bit more clear in where we're at here. And last year we went to Dimona in Israel, to the nuclear site in Dimona. To the desert, a lovely place to go. There's a lot of young people here. I invite you to go to the desert in Israel. It's a beautiful place. But when you stand at the nuclear site there, remember you're standing where they have 200 nuclear bombs, because Israel started the nuclear war in the Middle East. Israel has nuclear weapons. Iran is thinking about them, and Iraq got bombed for not having them. Israel has nuclear weapons, same as Britain has 200 nuclear weapons. But you know, the hope is that one Israeli professor said to me, we could rid the Middle East of nuclear weapons and all weapons of mass destruction, and we should do it now. And that's the exciting thing, because the Israeli nuclear peace activists want to start the movement to get rid of nuclear weapons, so that 10, 20 years up the road, we don't have Iran and Syria and Indonesia and every country under the world having a wee nuclear weapon. You see, that's what's crazy about us as people. We mimic each other. We follow each other. If he's got a nuclear bomb, I want a bigger one. I don't know what cultivates that kind of thinking, but that's the way it is. Everyone wants to be in the nuclear elite club. You know, is that a macho thing or something? I don't know. I would love to know, why do you need a nuclear bomb that A, costs a fortune to have, and B, you can't use anyway? You know, it's like having a pair of shoes and there's three on it, and you only have 2 feet. You can't use this thing. So we really have to say, in the Middle East, Israel should lead the movement to demolish nuclear weapons. And Israel should do that. And Israel could do that, you know. So Israel and America together, what a combination. Israel leading the Middle East, saying no nuclear weapons. And America saying no nuclear weapons. And then what would happen? Well, we don't need nuclear weapons anyway. Russia wouldn't need nuclear weapons. China wouldn't need nuclear weapons. It can be done. The only thing that's missing is the political will to make it happen. And I say to the young Americans in this audience today, you are the future generation. You start to make it happen. Because it is your world, and if you don't rid the world of nuclear weapons, your children will inherit the money that it costs to make them and a world that mightn't be worth living in. That's your challenge. And you know, when you talk about the immorality of having nuclear weapons, we'd lose our soul if we ever used them. Oh my God, how we'd lose our soul if you ever used them. Could we ever live with ourselves if you ever used them? But in a sense, the money they're costing, the billions of pounds they're costing now, today, even not to use them, but to make them. In America, 20 million people are living below the poverty line. Isn't that unbelievable in a rich world? And that's leaving aside children dying in Africa of starvation. I remember a teacher asking me in America to raise money to buy pencils for an American school because they didn't have pencils. When I first came to America, and went to downtown New York to visit the Dorothy Day Center and the homeless people, I was appalled and shocked at the poverty in America, which I have not seen in some other countries. So why are you wasting all this money on nuclear weapons when children in America are living below the poverty line? You know, we hear a whole lot about the Christian fundamentalists and about Christians in America. And my question is, why can't the Christians and the Christian fundamentalists find common ground to work on? I mean, isn't there an agenda there that we can agree upon? Because we're not going to do this on our own. And isn't surely the agenda that we're looking at today poverty in America and poverty in the world? And isn't surely the agenda we're looking at the environment? You know, we are global warming. We're polluting the earth. We're using up all our resources. We're leaving a world that will not be here for our children's children unless we start prioritizing and figuring out what our agenda is and how we can work together as a human family, not as one small group, but as a human family and through the United Nations. America supported the United Nations, and through international law, America played a great role in upholding human rights and international law. Roosevelt's wife was one of the ones who pushed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Remember your history. You were leaders in the field of international law and human rights. And now what is happening? This current administration is rolling back your civil liberties, your human rights. And where is the outrage against what is happening when you are being wiretapped? When we are having torture going on in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib? When we're having renditioning going on by Americans in different countries, these are all a total tearing up of international agreements and human rights and the Geneva Convention when we, the people of the world, worked to get all these. Your grandparents and their parents struggled for human rights when the American Constitution was written, and I might say being very proud by some of the Northern Ireland ancestry who helped write the Constitution. It was admired by people throughout the world as a great document. And what's happening now? It's been burnt before our eyes. And people around the world are horrified by what's going on in America. They are shocked by invasions and occupations and abuse of civil liberties and preemptive wars, and this current administration acting as if they were king of the world. A little bit of humility here, brothers and sisters. America is not the leader of the world. America hasn't got the moral fiber anymore to be leader of the world. And that is a tragedy, because the world needs America. It needs your courage. It needs your vision. It needs you of holding your constitution. It needs democracy. It needs human rights. It needs leadership of a spiritual and political kind that will give hope to the world. Because that's what's missing. That's what's missing in our world today. Do you know, in our world today, these young men, one of the greatest diseases is youth male suicide. Why are young men taking their lives? Because there's a lot of despair out there. There's a lot of sense of, my God, what's going to happen? Is it worth even living for? Is it worth having a baby? to pass on this kind of a world? That's the kind of questions being asked today by our youth. It's almost the politics of despair. And we got to turn that around. We got to have the world of hope and joy. And yes, people are great. People are wonderful. Do you know, I have people phone me up and say, I was out walking with my dog and I thought we could do this for peace. I was doing the washing the other day and I had this little idea that I could make this little thing for peace. People are so good. You gotta believe that. If they live in Afghanistan, China, North Korea, Iran, Belfast, Beirut, Birmingham, Alabama, people are great. But we gotta offer them hope. And the American administration has gotta offer hope to the world. We need them. And we have to hold our vision high. Our choice is, like Martin Luther King said, violence or non-violence. I have a belief that we can move away from violence, nuclear weapons, and war. And what's the alternative? Non-killing, non-violent societies. Why not? Why can't we have non-killing, non-violent societies? Why do we have this lie in our mind that we have a right to kill each other? Where did that lie in our mind come from? Because it's the lie in our mind we have to change. Because there'll always be nuclear technology. There'll always be weapons. But when we decide up there that we're not going to kill each other, that's the real revolution. That's what we really want to change. And you know, when I was in Belfast in Northern Ireland and I had to make the choice whether you ever took a gun or not, and I went before the crucifix, coming from a Christian tradition, and I looked at that crucifix and I got a very clear message when I needed it. And that message was to me, love your enemy, do not kill. And I came in then to understand that Jesus was totally nonviolent. He came to tell us that he rejected all the violence that had gone before, and that nonviolence was the only way forward. And I believe with that great American theologian, Father John L. Mackenzie, you cannot read the scriptures and not know that Jesus was totally non-violent. And you know, you read any of the great faith traditions, and all the founders of the great faith traditions, all were men of peace. And that's why all the faith traditions coming together to respect people, whatever their faith is or no faith, people have a right to make their choices, and we respect all those choices. But we must surely be able to agree that life is pretty precious, and that we shouldn't be killing each other, and that we've got to find alternatives. So I think we really need to look at how do we build the structures for the non-violent society. So we look at the alternative structures. We build institutions that are built on non-violence. We have non-violence and peace taught in all our schools, in our educations, and our governments. Each should have a peace and non-violent conflict resolution department. We have non-violent civilian defence forces, because people will always need human security, but we can do it non-violently. We look at all these alternative structures and we build an international charter of non-violence for the human family. That we can do. You know, tell you what we'll do. We'll give it to the University of California to make, to write up that international charter for non-violence. What do you think? You know, we have a lot of hard work ahead of us. But when Senator Mitchell came to Northern Ireland, and I say, great man that he was, I think we should send him to Iraq. But he made 3 points, and I thought they were marvellous. And you know, when he was coming to Northern Ireland, his young wife was expecting her son, their son, and he kept coming back and forward, and the little boy was born, and I'm sure they're all doing well. But he was a diplomat who'd wisdom, you know, and maybe that's where we're missing. You know, Gandhi always said, we needed the intellect. Well, we've had the intellect for the last century. Now we need the wisdom. And we've had a lot of men in the last century. Now we need more women. But I really think you need that balance. You need that balance of the head and the heart. You need the heart. People are heart people. We're not all head. We're not all logic. And if we create a civilization with a heart, and we bring our wisdom to look at the questions and the important rationale and logic, you know, if we bring the wisdom to it, then I think we'll get better answers to the problems that we're facing today. And so let's have more of a balance in the way we answer our problems. So when we're looking at issues like, do we need nuclear weapons? Yes, the head tells us we do need nuclear weapons. But by God, the head tells us, what in God's name is a nuclear weapon going to be any use to us for? So let's bring the heart into it. And let's challenge our leaders to lead the world in a better way. But I say that, I still think that Bush and Blair took the world to war against the wishes of the vast majority of the people around the world. 11 million people in hundreds of countries marched to say no to war, and they ignored that. So I think Bush and Blair have got to be made accountable for ignoring the wishes of the international community. And I think our biggest challenge now is to say, we're hearing all this saber-rattling going on about Iran. We must challenge the media to tell the truth this time round that Iran is not a threat to the international community. And we must go out to make friends with Korea and Iran, and where our governments start demonizing a people, we must say, no, they are our brothers and sisters. The American peace activists were going in over the wall during the Cold War to build friends with the Russian people before the wall ever came down. It didn't happen by miracle. So go out there, build friends, because the only people, as in Northern Ireland, to solve the problem of Northern Ireland will be us becoming good friends in Northern Ireland and trusting each other. And the only way that we're going to build this human family is when each of us is prepared to pay the price, to make sacrifices, and to go out to people of different cultures and religions and look them straight in the eye and say, hey, brothers, let's start solving these problems without killing each other. It is possible, and it can be done. And thank you very much for listening to me.
We have time for a few questions, and there are microphones in the front on either side. So if you have a question, please come forward and ask it.
How do you propose to bridge the disconnect between the peoples of various nations and their governments? Because obviously the British people didn't want to go to war, but Blair went anyway. A huge proportion of American people didn't want to go to war, but they went anyway. Large numbers of Israelis don't want the wall and don't want Palestinian devastation, but the Israeli government's going forward with that policy anyway. How do you bridge the disconnect between the government and the people?
Did you all hear the question all right? Yes. I think this is one of the most important questions that we really have got to find an answer to, because there's almost a double thing going on here. There's a huge movement around the world of people wanting to do things in a different way. And when you connect those movements up, you know, you have the environmental movement, the human rights movement, the women's movements. I mean, you could go on and on. And this huge, massive movement of people at the bottom. And somehow, the movement of people is here, and the political leaders are over here doing their own thing. And I really feel if we can figure out how to bring together those two, because we all need each other. You know, we do need good leaders, good politicians, and if we can kind of bring them together in some way, that they're connecting, and that political leaders are recognising that people are on a different agenda than where they're at. And we can only keep marching for peace, emailing for peace, lobbying for peace, and building up particularly the people's movement through emails and connecting to each other. So we're giving each other strength and support and ideas, building coalitions as much as possible, and finding common ground that we can all work on so that we are pushing the politicians to deal with the real issues. But that is the most, you know, if you find the answer to that, let me know. Because that is, I think, one of the most important questions that we have to find an answer to.
Sorry, you mentioned in your speech that there was no more honor in war. And I just want to say, I've also been in the Amaria shelter, and I've been in Abu Ghraib, and I've seen some stuff that, like you said, will live with you forever. But there's also soldiers out there that are there to do the right thing. They feel that they're there to do the right thing. They might not agree with the policies that are coming down from the top, but I know that I was responsible for about $3 million worth of projects to rebuild hospitals and schools and give back to the community. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but we were one small team doing what we could, and I think it does start with the fact that my team never abused anyone. We never mistreated anyone. And now that I'm here, I'm in school, I'm learning a lot of different things, coming to things like this. I think that if I ever do go back, I'll be able to do a lot more. And there are people doing good things there. It's just the media doesn't ever cover the good things that are still being done in that country. So.
You know, I think all any of us can do is work out of an informed conscience and do what our conscience tells us to be right and that we can follow. And, you know, that's really up to... If anyone does that, then that's the thing to do. And serve each other and help each other as much as we can. And then you can sleep well at night and you know you have done good. But I think the tragedy can be sometimes that when people get into organisations, be it something like the army, and they're given orders from on top, and they feel they can't say no to this order because they're into the system. I think that is where the danger arises. So nobody's taken responsibility for what is happening. Everybody's saying, well, it's President Bush or it's Tony Blair. It's really nothing to do with me. I'm not part of that. And I think we really have to take the responsibility onto ourselves. We've rights, but we have responsibilities. You know, somebody makes the bombs that are dropped. So where does the buck start and where does it end? In the Amariah shelter, when over 400, and you've been there, 400 women and children were killed. You know, in Derry, in the north of Ireland, we have Raytheon, which is the second largest arms manufacturer in America. And we have people who are making these computer parts that are put into the planes that operate over Iraq and that drop the bomb. Who's responsible for the death of 400 women and children? Well, it wasn't the young computer whiz kids in Derry who work for Raytheon. It wasn't them. They're only doing their job. It wasn't the pilot. He's only following orders. It wasn't the president because they don't take responsibility. The thing is, somebody has to take responsibility and say, it's going to end here. So I'm not saying, you know, young people in the army, if in good conscience they feel they can do that, they have God the answer to as well. But we have to somehow get down to the personal responsibility of who takes responsibility for what happens at the other end, and that's what we're saying, you know.
So I think that it's a really important note to end the evening's discussion on, and I think we might all leave tonight's lecture with the thought of personal responsibility in our minds, which really is the question: what can I do? What is my responsibility? What do I need to do to set things right? And I hope it is a question that each of you, each of us, will take along with us tonight, and not only take the question along, but think about it and come back with answers that each of us can find for ourselves and do the things that we need to do to set things right in this country, in this world. So please join me once again in thanking Mairead for making the long trip here to share her message of love and nonviolence.